The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
It's the Sound Off Christmas Show, episode 306, for Sunday, December 22nd, 2013. I am the Solemn Monster. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas to all those who celebrate listening to the show here this week. A show that you can listen to on thesolemnmonster.com, in Stitcher Radio, or in iTunes. And I have to apologize here right off the bat. If you hear any banging in the background, any little thumping noises, there is a man outside my window in the backyard area on a shed next door doing some roofing on this shed, and he loves smashing his hammer repeatedly, over and over and over again. I would love to take that hammer and smash him over the head with it, but in the spirit of the holidays, I will not do that. So if you hear anything, that's what it is. I apologize. Want to give PayPal shout-outs to Tom Scarangelo, Jazz Ernstmeyer, and Donde Page, who were kind enough to make contributions to the show. You can do so on thesolemnmonster.com, and I would very much appreciate that. But the big news of the week, got to get to this first. Daryl Hall and John Oates being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next year. It's about damn time, that's all I can say. Some of my earliest childhood memories are of me dancing and singing to various Hall & Oates music videos. Out of Touch is one of my favorite all-time songs. Private Eyes, Family Man, 6 number one hits these men had. It wasn't an injustice the way Randy Savage being left out of the WWE Hall of Fame is, but I'm glad they're going in, and joining them are some jabroni bands like Kiss and Nirvana. Undercard acts, that's what they are. We all know who the real main event is. And interestingly, the induction ceremony is April 14th, the same week I get back from New Orleans from WrestleMania, and it's from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Interesting. So, congratulations to them. The big story that broke this weekend, the return of the Animal, Batista. Word slipped out that Batista is, in fact, on his way back to WWE just in time for WrestleMania season. The ticket website for the Thomas & Mack Center in Las Vegas had a posting which has since been taken down, I believe. All mentions, there was another mention, I think somebody connected to the Phoenix Suns Twitter account also said that Batista was going to be at an event there the day before, but all mentions, it appears, have been scrubbed. Somebody's going to get in trouble for this, because I'm sure WWE is not very happy. It sounds as though Batista perhaps was going to be saved as a surprise entrant, and maybe he still will be. I don't know how much of a surprise it'll be now for the Royal Rumble. And this is not a case of the dirt sheet spoiling anything. This is the website for the arena getting advertising from WWE in advance, and then for whatever reason, the weekend before Christmas, they decide to put the advertising out there for the world to see, and now it's, you know, with Twitter and everything else, it just spreads like wildfire. But the listing said, you know, see the return of the Animal Batista live, and then PW Insider went and checked with their sources, and other people, Meltzer, they checked with, you know, his sources, and pretty much confirmed that Batista is back. Nobody seems to know exactly for how long, but he has a movie coming out next August, Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the biggest role of his career thus far. That's going to be a big movie. So maybe he'll go away in the summertime to promote it, or maybe he'll stick around and use WWE as a way to promote it. So he's going to be back, it appears, at least for a period of several months, from just prior to WrestleMania through Mania and beyond. And The Observer had mentioned that he's in for a significant role, whatever that means. And to his credit, I have to say, Dave Meltzer first had an item about Batista in talks to return to WWE in his newsletter earlier in the week, a good 3 days before this news broke. So there was at least one person out there reporting that Batista was probably on his way back. And Batista has talked a lot about, you know, in the past when he gets asked about it, coming back only for an extended run. He's not one of these guys who wants to come back just for one WrestleMania match and then up and leave. He wants to come back for the long haul. And the reason he left the company in 2010, if you remember, the last program he had was with John Cena. And they had that big, I don't know if it was a last man standing match or what it was, when Cena gave him the attitude adjustment off the stage. And Batista legit injured his tailbone. showed up on Raw the next night in a wheelchair, and he says, you know, you people don't appreciate me, I quit. And that was the last we ever saw of him. And one of the reasons he left was he was not a fan of the PG direction of WWE that the company adopted in 2008. Batista loved the, you know, when he first came in, 04, 05, even then it wasn't the Attitude Era, but it definitely wasn't a PG product. You had more violence and more coarse language and blood. And that's the kind of stuff Batista's into. Batista's the kind of guy who would fit perfectly into that era from the late 90s. In a PG era, he's just not a big fan. So I'm a little surprised. I can't say that much has changed. It's not like WWE has shied away from PG. I'm sure they probably put a bunch of money in his face, and he's got this big movie coming out, and he figures, you know, he can come back, and fans will start talking about him again, and it'll help when he has to promote his movie. And you know what? That's smart, and there's nothing wrong with that. I was always really sad when Batista went away, because I felt like that douchey heel character when Batista would come out wearing the vest and the sunglasses as a heel was the best incarnation of the Batista character I've ever seen. And he was so entertaining. You know, as a wrestler, he was fine. He improved over the years, so in the ring, he was fine. The character, though, was awesome, and then he left. The character was only around for maybe 3 or 4 months before he left the company, so I always felt like we never really got to fully enjoy that version of Big Dave. I don't see him coming back in that same role just because somebody like him, he's been gone now for, you know, it's going to be 4 years. When you come back after that much time off and you're a big star, you're automatically going to get cheered. And that doesn't mean they can't then turn him or position him as a heel, but that's just not the right role. If Batista comes back, he's going to be this huge babyface, and that's just how it's going to be. So who does he face? You know, now the question turns to WrestleMania, and it makes WrestleMania more, you know, of an interesting card in that everyone's talking, where does John Cena fit in, and Orton, and Bryan, and Punk, and Brock, and Undertaker, and all these different people. Is RVD going to come back? Is Jericho going to come back? What match is Triple H going to have? Because you're damn well guaranteed that Triple H is going to want to wrestle on that show. Now you throw Batista in the mix, and it becomes a little murkier. When I look at the layout right now and the landscape of WWE and the main event scene, I can easily see Batista with either Triple H, John Cena, or Randy Orton. This so-called significant role they have planned for Batista, maybe it's a WWE Championship match. And if that's the case, Batista versus Orton, I can see that. Batista and Cena would make sense. The last feud Batista was in was with John Cena. John Cena basically sent him packing from WWE. They can rekindle that feud. Although, again, people might cheer Batista more, but Cena's the babyface, so I don't know if you do babyface against babyface or how you work that out. And then there's Triple H, and I would not at all be shocked to see a Batista-Triple H match at WrestleMania. They've been building towards Punk and Triple H in recent weeks. It seems like that's the direction they're going in, but who knows? I mean, it looked like they were building to a Bryan-Triple H match at some point, and I don't want to say that that's been completely abandoned, but much like Triple H Big Show, it never happened. And I don't know that it is going to happen. So even though it looks like Punk and Triple H may be the direction, they could very easily just stop it cold. And just because I don't know that they even know where Triple H fits into the picture at Mania. There had been the talk of at some point there's a rift that forms where Vince doesn't like the fact that Triple H and Stephanie seem to be assuming a lot more power than perhaps they actually have. And Vince wants to take back control of his own company from his power-hungry son-in-law and daughter. And so Vince has a representative, which WWE supposedly wanted Steve Austin for. Austin is not wrestling. He's not wrestling ever again, I'm convinced of that. Especially after the comments he made on Chris Jericho's podcast. So they're not going to get Stone Cold. It doesn't look like The Rock is going to be available for Mania next year. What about Batista? What if Batista's big return is tied into him representing Vince against Triple H, his old buddy? I am positive that Batista would want to wrestle Triple H again. He loves Triple H. He's, you know, they're like bosom buddies. He came back to do Triple H's DVD project, which I reviewed on YouTube. I did a whole review for his Thy Kingdom Come DVD, and there was Big Dave, and I was shocked because he hasn't done anything with the company in recent years, but they brought him in for these fresh interviews. And of course, he's lavishing praise on Triple H and how great he was and what a big influence he was. And he should, because Triple H put this guy over. You know, you can argue how many guys Triple H has really put over over the last, you know, decade since he's been really in the top spot. Batista's got to be at the very top of that list. Hunter lost the championship to him at WrestleMania in a main event that did over a million buys. So the promotion they did for the first Batista Triple H match, it worked. That show didn't have any celebrities. It didn't have any big names. I mean, it had Austin in a Piper's Pit segment, but that show was sold on Batista challenging for the world championship, and Triple H put him over. He put him over on a second pay-per-view. He put him over a third straight time in a Hell in a Cell match. So I could see Batista wanting to work with Hunter again and, you know, beating Hunter and winning control of the company back for Vince. That to me would be the most likely scenario. I can't really see Batista against anybody else. Batista against Punk or Bryan or Sheamus. You know, if Sheamus is back in time for WrestleMania, Brock. You know, I don't see any of those matches happening. I still say Sheamus gets forgotten a lot. If Sheamus is okay for WrestleMania, and he's had some setbacks in his recovery from shoulder surgery, so nobody seems to know when Sheamus is going to be back. Even the Rumble is not a guarantee. I did a whole Yahoo column on this a few months ago, and as much as I still would love to see, you know, Daniel Bryan in a much higher position on the card, maybe winning the Rumble, and, you know, even if he's not challenging for the title, I still think him and Triple H is a match that would do well. Him and Shawn Michaels, if Shawn wants to come back, which I don't think he does. But there's a story there for Sheamus in that when he comes back, Sheamus should come back as a heel, and the first person he should go after, maybe representing the authority, is Daniel Bryan. There's a built-in story there because Bryan is the guy, if they want to remind everybody, who injured Sheamus in that Money in the Bank ladder match in the first place. And Bryan took away all these months of his career. So again, there's a built-in story there if when Sheamus is ready to come back, he does so as a heel and he attacks Daniel Bryan. And they can go in that direction. And Bryan and Sheamus have had a ton of matches before. They work great together. They've got a chemistry kind of like John Cena and CM Punk do, where they just have great matches all the time. So I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued to see where Batista fits into all this and where Sheamus, if he's able to come back in time. I mean, in that respect, there's a certain level of excitement, I guess, for WrestleMania because we don't know where they're going to go yet, and there's a ton of different possibilities. And just introducing Batista into the mix just muddies the whole thing, and I'm not quite sure where they're going to go. But I think that match against Triple H, even more so than Cena, is a direction I could see them going in. A week ago on Sunday, WWE had its TLC pay-per-view, and they in fact did go ahead and unify the championships. So there is now one, as they're calling it, WWE World Heavyweight Champion. And as I tweeted that night, LOL to the people who voted for Unified Champion in that poll. I told you when you voted in that poll on Raw the week before on what they should call the title, that it wasn't going to mean a damn thing. And it didn't. You know what, though? I actually thought they would go with Unified Champion for at least 2 weeks before they decided to say, you know, screw it, we're going to go with what we want. They didn't even wait that long. It was the very next night. They just went with their own name. I thought it was a decent show, maybe even a good show. I mean, the bar has been set very, very low after the previous three or four pay-per-views. It was, I don't want to say impossible, but it was going to be pretty close to impossible to have a worse show. I suppose if they would have given us another screwjob ending, it would have sucked. But it was a good show. You know, they had Ziggler and Fandango in the pre-show match, and the only thing I can say about that is Dolph Ziggler going from headlining TLC last year and beating John Cena to losing to Fandango on the pre-show 1 year later, what more can be said? You know, you look at Raw Monday night, it looks like they're starting some sort of storyline. They had an interview, I guess, on the app with Dolph Ziggler talking about what a shit year he's had, and this is going to be the beginning of a turnaround, that he rolled up Fandango in some cheap win on Monday, and I think that's where his luck ends, if the spoilers for this week are any indication. So I don't know what the hell they're doing with this guy. It's just a complete waste of talent. Even if you're not the kind of person who buys Dolph Ziggler as a world champion, you can't logically argue at this point that they're not just completely wasting this guy. The best thing on the entire show was the Fatal 4-Way match they had for the tag team titles. That was a hell of a match. It was an elimination match, especially the last 5 minutes. It came down to two babyface teams, which I didn't expect. The Rhodes Brothers against Big Show and Rey Mysterio. Goldust is just amazing. He just continues to impress. I think it was in that match he busted out some I don't know if it was a Hurricane Rana. It was some kind of wacky move that I don't even think I ever saw Goldust do back when he was the natural. Dustin Rhodes, back in the early 90s. So this guy at 42 or 43, whatever he is busting out moves and doing things that he couldn't do or didn't do 20 years earlier. And it's a lot of fun to watch. The TLC match between Cena and Orton, you know, it was a good match. It was by no means the best TLC match I've ever seen. It was not even close to being the best Cena-Orton match. I think you would have had a better match had it just been a straight singles match. And this notion that you have to add stipulations, it's like, you know, what they did on Impact this week, and I'll get into Impact later, I actually really enjoyed it, was this Dixieland match where they're crowning a new world champion, but you got to climb out of a cage, and then you got to crawl down the aisleway and climb a ladder, and the belt is hanging, and this notion that you're going to crown your new world champion, you know, just by yanking a belt down from a cable, it's kind of dumb. Why don't you just put the two guys in the ring one-on-one? May the best man win. Whoever wins the match by pinfall or submission is your champion. And I think we would have gotten a better match that way. So you have two guys in there, two headline guys. Orton is made of glass. You know, you never know when he's going to get hurt. He's had collarbone issues before, and his shoulders popped out. His shoulder popped out throwing a punch at one point earlier in the year. Cena's all banged up. He's not getting any younger. His elbow, I can't accept the fact that his elbow is 100%. I don't think it is. And so you had ladders that were not that high. The belts were actually kind of low. Somebody even remarked to me that we were watching it, and he said, boy, those belts seem like they're really low. Maybe they're going to, you know, raise them up a little bit more when these guys start climbing. And they never did, because they didn't want these guys climbing, you know, ridiculous heights. And I get that. Why put them in a TLC match, though? So the finish was kind of a botch. Cena got knocked off the ladder. He was supposed to go crashing through the table. He didn't. His head hit the bottom. Maybe the bottom part of the table cracked. It looked bad, but Cena knocked himself out on the table. That was the story they told. And Orton took his time. Orton took so much time that everybody was waiting for the swerve. The fact that we actually got a clean finish to this match was a swerve. Everybody was waiting for somebody to come out, for Triple H's music to hit, and it never happened. Norton just slowly, you know, climbed up, he grabbed the belts, and that was it. And out came the Authority to celebrate, and that's how the pay-per-view went off the air. And I think I said, you know, I tweeted when the show was over, I'd give the whole thing about a 6 out of 10. That's pretty much what it was. If you missed the pay-per-view and you wanted, oh, should I buy the DVD or whatever, I wouldn't. I wouldn't bother. It's not really worth it. But if you saw the show, you know, it was good. It was good for what it was. And, you know, it's funny, I had a run-in with some die-hard John Cena fans this weekend. Not really a run-in, like, in the flesh, thank God, but on Twitter. I posted a photo of a shirt that I saw at the mall that read, "If Cena wins, we complain online." Right, as a play off the whole "if Cena wins, we riot" thing. And I thought it was funny. I thought it was actually fantastic. I saw that, and I just thought it was great. So I tweeted a photo of it, and I said how true it is. You know, fans will find any reason to complain about John Cena on the internet. That's a fact. It wasn't meant as anything disparaging or disrespectful about John Cena. I happen to like John Cena. I think the online hatred of him is way overblown. It's just beyond reasonable. And some creature, it's the only way I can describe him, who runs a John Cena Twitter fan page, starts sending me derogatory messages, calling me an SOB, and he's telling people to block me, and then he starts using gay slurs on me, which is always the sign of a rational person when they have to resort to that. And he gets his minions to start doing the same thing, and it's hilarious because I never said a cross word about Cena. You know, I have no clue what I said that set this guy off. I think what happened is, here's my view of what happened. He's obviously never gotten laid a day in his life. This kid wouldn't know a woman's touch if one of them brushed up against him by accident at the McDonald's he probably works at. And so he's frustrated, you know, and he takes it out on other people. And it's actually really sad. John Cena has some frightening fans out there. So my advice to this guy and people of his ilk, I'm talking the crazy ones, who have no real prospects, they hate themselves, and so they take it out on other people. Ask Santa for a life this year. That's my advice. Or better yet, go find some porn online. Okay, whatever you're into. Seeing as how you like hurling gay slurs at people, I'm willing to bet there's some self-loathing going on there. So if you're into that sort of thing, hey, go for it. Maybe that'll help you calm down a little bit. I think the porn route is actually a lot safer. That way these people can't reproduce. But man, there are some scary people out there. Raw from last Monday night, the night after TLC, was from Dallas, Texas. Three things worth going out of your way to see on this show. CM Punk and the Usos against The Shield. Tamina Snuka super kicking Nikki Bella's jaw into the 18th row. And the Randy Orton versus Daniel Bryan main event. The Punk match was just a lot of fun, I thought. It's no real surprise given who was involved. This time, Roman Reigns actually got the spear on Punk, unlike the night before at the pay-per-view where he hit Ambrose by accident. So, even Steven booking at its finest. The Shield is probably my favorite wrestling trio of all time. I was hesitant to say that, but I think now it's been over a year, and just all the great matches they've had on TV, on pay-per-view, I think it's safe to say now, for me anyway, favorite trio of all time. And I know the Freebirds, I know I'm still going to go ahead and say The Shield. They're just fantastic. Of course, why Punk even needed us to vote on his partners in this match on Raw after he beat all three guys by himself the night before, I have no idea. But he lost this time, so maybe having partners only serves to distract him. I don't know. The Divas stopwatch went 5 minutes and 12 seconds, which is long, so they actually gave the women some time this week. AJ pinned Nikki after a knee to the face, but the real story here was Nikki having AJ up on her shoulders for a torture rack. She turns around, and she turns right into a super kick by Tamina that would have brought a tear to Shawn Michaels' lazy eye. She kicked her so hard in the face. It sounded great. It looked great. Nikki wouldn't take her hand away from her mouth when it was over, so I figured she probably had some teeth loosened. And she may have. She tweeted a picture afterwards of nothing but a bloody towel. They ought to slap her jaw on a milk carton. If anyone finds it, please return it to John Cena. And then there was the main event. I don't really have a whole lot to add to what I've already seen people talking about this week. I mean, it was great. It was a great, great match. The opening segment with John Cena arguing that Bryan should get a shot at Orton's title instead of him getting his own rematch, being the stand-up guy that he is. You know, it certainly made you think that you were getting a championship match. I'm sure that was by design. They wanted you to think that. But about halfway through the show, it was obvious to me anyway it was non-title because the graphics never said it was for the championship. It was just one-on-one. And if it was a title match, they would have hyped the shit out of it. I think it would have really added to it. And you could do the exact same finish with Orton giving Bryan a low blow for the DQ. You know, another fuck finish in an Orton-Bryan match, but at least I didn't have to pay $50 for it this time. It did make you hate Randy Orton, though, which is, I think, is the whole point. So after my initial reaction, like, I see the low blow, and my initial reaction is, ah, come on. Really? After that wore off, though, you know, the finish was fine. I was shocked they didn't have Orton beat Bryan straight up, fair and square. I thought for sure that's what they were going to do. The story they told heading into TLC with John Cena's promo during that whole championship ascension ceremony was how Orton had never met the expectations that were set for him. He's always taking shortcuts. And at the pay-per-view, he beat Cena clean. That was a clean win. Even the handcuffs, I mean, Orton did nothing in that match that was against the rules. He played by the rules, and he won, fair and square. So he finally beat Cena straight up. And here, the story they told was Orton cannot beat Daniel Bryan straight up in a fair fight. So I thought he'd beat Bryan here to prove that he can, and then he would move on to a rematch with Cena at the Royal Rumble. And Cena and Orton were both, or Cena and Bryan, I should say, were both laid out with Orton standing over them at the end of Raw. So it looks like we may be getting a three-way at the Rumble, which I think is a mistake. Bryan needs to be in the Rumble match. Either do the Cena versus Orton rematch or find a different challenger and put Cena in the Rumble also. I don't want him to win, but he'd add to the star power in there. And Bryan absolutely belongs in the Rumble match. So anyway, the main event was worth the money I paid for the pay-per-view. And you didn't even need tables or ladders or chairs. Just a straight-up wrestling match, 25 minutes of excellence. Probably the first or second best TV match the two have had all year. And light years better than any of the pay-per-view matches they've had since SummerSlam. And Randy Orton deserves a lot of credit. He was every bit as great as Bryan was in this match. He was aggressive, more so than usual. He does all the little things well. And there was a superplex spot where Orton suplexed Bryan from the top rope. It was a super duperplex is the only way I can describe it. I mean, he went up top and launched himself even higher into the air when he jumped off. That landing looked brutal for both of them. Just one of the best Raw main events all year. Brodus Clay completed his heel turn by pulling his hand away from Tenzai as he went for a tag during their match against R-Truth and Xavier Woods. Yes, the same finish we just saw them use with Miz and Kofi Kingston only a few weeks earlier. If it follows the same pattern, Brodus will be back on TV this week as a babyface, like nothing ever happened. Funkadactyls were disgusted by this. Yeah, if this were the Attitude Era, Brodus totally would have squashed them both in the middle of the ring. Can't really say I missed that. Actually, that HLA segment on Raw, remember that? That was probably back in like 03. I think Bischoff was the GM. They had a segment with 3-minute warning. Yeah, it was during the whole Ruthless Aggression era period. I watched that segment recently when they had 3-minute warning beat up the two hoes. And I have to say, you know, watching it back all these years later, it's one of the most appalling segments in Raw history. I think one of the women actually legitimately suffered broken ribs during that segment when they got squashed. Count me as one of those people who agrees the show is much better for not having that kind of stuff anymore. We had a segment on Raw Monday with CM Punk and Shawn Michaels that would have been great if it was the launching point for a Punk-Michaels match at Mania, but it's not. And actually, this segment was a complete waste of Shawn Michaels. He didn't really do anything. Although I did love heel HBK here, snapping at the fans after they started chanting, "You sold out," at him. And when the chant started to die down, he made fun of them for getting blown up and not being able to keep up with him. How many guys has he worked with in his career where he's probably said the same thing to them? I'm guessing Vader was probably one of them. So then Michaels told the fans to shut their pie holes. He said, "I got a car waiting outside." And he did, because he didn't stick around very long. You know, in a different era, Shawn Michaels and Triple H against CM Punk and Daniel Bryan is a match I would have paid to see. But that's not what this segment was here for. It was there for Michaels to simply introduce the Shield before the six-man match I mentioned. And then he vanished, and he was never seen again. So I guess it was just a matter of, hey, we're in Texas, and you're not that far away, so why don't you come on in and just do a quick segment for us? Just a waste, really, of Shawn Michaels. The only other thing on this show I want to mention was this nonsense with the announcers during the Rhodes Brothers Big Show Rey Mysterio match, where they decided this would be a wonderful time to start taking selfies at ringside. I guess this was Vince McMahon's way of mocking Obama for getting caught taking a selfie at Nelson Mandela's funeral. You know, one would have been bad enough, but Lawler said the first photo didn't come out well, so they ended up doing it again. And meanwhile, you've got four guys in the ring busting their asses. If I'm those guys, I find that just incredibly insulting to look over and see these three bozos taking pictures of themselves at ringside. You don't take fucking pictures of yourself during a match unless your name is Tyler Breeze. Okay, that should be a rule going forward in WWE. Just complete stupidity. And we have another hokey Christmas episode of Raw this Monday night. Remember last year they killed Santa Claus and then he no-sold it and came back at the end of the show. This year, it's Damian Sandow as Bad Santa against Mark Henry as Good Santa. So Fox News will not be happy with there being a Black Santa on Raw this week. Whatever, you know, it's for the kids. They already taped the show on Tuesday. Small spoiler alert here, so if you don't want to hear anything that happens or is going to happen on Raw this Monday, just tune away for 60 seconds. I'm not really giving away any match results, but the good news is that if you're a fan of wrestling, they taped 9 matches for the show this Monday, including a main event of John Cena, CM Punk, and Big E Langston against The Shield, which almost guarantees to be awesome. The bad news is there's also a 12 Diva Jingle Bells match, which sounds like a disaster waiting to happen, having that many women in one match. There's also going to be a pole match between Fandango and Dolph Ziggler, with the winner getting an Intercontinental title shot on the December 30th episode of Raw next week. And might I suggest they call it a North Pole match? I have no idea if that's the name they're using, but that's what I would use, so I guess we'll find out. You know, one of our listeners, Fabian, who's been a fan of the show for a long, long time, he wrote in with a mailbag question that kind of touched on this idea, and he and I had the same thought, and I wanted to bring it up here. And I know this is all fantasy because I don't see it happening, but in going over all the possible WrestleMania scenarios for the title involving John Cena or Randy Orton or CM Punk or Daniel Bryan, and even now Batista, one name you don't hear mentioned too often is Brock Lesnar. And the more I think about it, I kind of like the idea of Paul Heyman leading Brock Lesnar to a title win over Orton, which would lead to a Punk-Lesnar rematch at WrestleMania with Punk getting the belt. Or Daniel Bryan as the underdog against Brock Lesnar as a match we've never seen before. I think that'd actually be a hell of a big man, small man match. I really think their styles, as stiff as those two can be, would make for a fun match. There's money. There's money in Brock as the monster heel champion. If only for a couple of months. I don't know how many dates they would be able to get him on TV for, but they had Rock on a limited schedule, and he was the champion, and I'd have to think they could get Brock on Raw more often than they did The Rock. Right now, the way they're setting things up, I know it doesn't make any sense. I'm just saying it could work. Maybe the Authority isn't happy with all of Orton's whining and complaining and, you know, his inability to put Daniel Bryan away on his own. So Heyman strikes a deal with Triple H, and that's how Brock gets the shot, which leaves Bryan, Cena, and Punk all for the Rumble match. Because you want to have some big names in the Rumble, like I said before, all of whom could conceivably win the whole thing, right? I mean, John Cena, CM Punk, or Daniel Bryan all could realistically win the Royal Rumble in 2014. Cena is absolutely the wrong choice, especially since he just won it this year. But I could see any of those three winning. And if it was to come down to those three at the end, I think that'd be a pretty cool sight. That would make for a pretty eventful final 5 or 10 minutes of the Rumble match. But what I like about Brock in there as the wild card in this whole scenario is that you could plug either Punk or Bryan in, and either one of them would work. Punk probably more so because of the history with Paul Heyman and the fact that Brock has a win over him already at SummerSlam. That and the fact that the two of them had the match of the year in WWE, in my opinion. So, you know, Punk gets his main event at WrestleMania, which I'm sure makes him very happy. I don't really care either way if he gets the main event. You make $1 million and you're banging AJ Lee. So, poor you. I don't really give a shit. But I think a match with Bryan also would work. And you'll have people who point to the SummerSlam buy rate and they argue, oh, what a horrible move it would be to put Punk versus Lesnar in the main event because it didn't draw the first time. In fairness, we don't know if it was Punk and Lesnar or Bryan versus Cena that the fans weren't into. It's unfair to lay full blame on one match over the other because we just don't know. I still maintain that if promoted properly with Lesnar as the defending heel champion, it absolutely could sell. A million buys on its own? No, of course not. But WrestleMania, you know, WrestleMania is all about the different attractions. You round out the card with a couple of other big names. Batista, it sounds like, is going to be back. Maybe Hogan. I mean, who knows? And I think WrestleMania is going to do just fine. I think the biggest question is what effect this new network will have on WrestleMania if they're going to offer it as part of their subscription package. That'll be the bigger story if it hurts their pay-per-view business. I know they've probably got their plans, Lesnar versus Undertaker or whatever. And that'll be a huge match if they do it. Brock against The Undertaker, if they go in that direction, that's going to be huge. But if you do it this way, it's all good. It still works because that frees up Undertaker for that match with John Cena that I've talked about. Or maybe he runs the gauntlet against The Shield, which was another idea I pitched last week. That's the key, though. If you do Undertaker and The Shield, it has to be gauntlet style, not this three-on-one all-at-once BS. You start with Seth Rollins. Somehow Undertaker gets through Dean Ambrose next, but barely. And then get people thinking that Roman Reigns will actually finish the job and take credit for ending the streak. But maybe Ambrose gets jealous. You know, I softened him up. Why should he get the credit for ending the streak? Or something like that. Undertaker wins, of course. But it plays into the Shield breakup that we get then on Raw the next night. Or hell, do Roman Reigns and The Undertaker. They've got big plans for Roman Reigns. I still don't see Reigns winning the Rumble. And I don't think it's time for him to do that. I think you can give him a whole bunch of eliminations, but then have Ambrose and or Rollins throw him out, and that causes even more dissension. Do something like that. But you could do Roman Reigns and The Undertaker straight up if you want to. One-on-one. Reigns loses, looks strong in defeat, and then after the match, Rollins and Ambrose turn on him, like what Hall and Nash did with Hogan back at WrestleMania 18. I just hope whatever WWE decides on, it's something that we could really get excited about. I'm paying a lot of money to go to that show in New Orleans, okay? I'm paying a hell of a lot more than $55 on pay-per-view. So I have a vested interest in them doing what's right on this damn show. And while I'm on the subject of Punk and Brian, I have a note here to talk about this. I want to address something. I see some people, not a lot, but a select few numbskulls who, whenever you pitch an idea for either CM Punk or Daniel Bryan, you know, you get the same reaction. Oh, they're just indie geeks. You're just a mark for indie geeks. Yes, because I cover so much indie wrestling on my show every week, of course. But I laugh at it because do these people not realize that CM Punk has now been under contract with WWE longer than he ever competed on the indie scene? He went to Ohio Valley in 2005. That's 8 years with WWE. At what point do you drop the label of indie geek? I would love to know the answer to this question. They put their world title on the guy for over a year. He's wrestled all the top talent. He's one of the top three most overstars in the entire company. He spent 5 years working indies, and you still have a select few idiots who don't seem to realize this. I think Punk shed the indie label a long time ago. Just because Kevin Nash said it in a promo on TV once doesn't make it true. Now Brian, at least, you know, he's only been with WWE for, what, 3 or 4 years? Does that make him an indie geek? An indie geek, to me, is someone who thinks they're better than they actually are. They do a bunch of spots that don't mean anything, just for the sake of doing them, and they don't actually go anywhere in their career. Once you sign with WWE and you spend a few years there and you get over and you start making big money and you're wrestling in front of 10,000 people instead of 150 people, I don't really see how that term applies. That's like saying, oh, Chris Jericho is still an indie geek. You know, he wrestled for Smoky Mountain in front of less than 1,000 people, and then he worked for ECW in a bingo hall. The only marks are the ones who actually throw around that term. So I just wanted to put that out there. Earlier in the week, Variety posted a major story that had a lot of new information about WWE's TV negotiations and some new stuff on the network. And it's important enough, I just wanted to run through this here really quickly. One of the more interesting parts about this interview that they did with Michelle Wilson from WWE, they have a quote from her, where they admit that they have evolved their thinking, because for the longest time, WWE hated the sports label. We're not sport, we're entertainment. We're like Saturday Night Live, and we're like this show, and we're like that show. Even though we would see these did-you-know facts on television shoved down our throat every week about how their DVDs were number one in the sports category on the Billboard charts. Oh, I thought you weren't a sport. But, you know, when it's convenient for them, they're a sport. And it just so happens that now it's convenient for them again to be a sport. So they've evolved their thinking. And their new stance, as Michelle Wilson says here, she says, we're clearly entertainment-based, but if you think about the characteristics of our brand, it's live action and that's sports. We want to be compensated for a live audience since live content is getting a very significant premium in the marketplace. Basically, what that means is they see all the money, the shitload of money that NASCAR and the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball have gotten in their TV rights agreements, and they think they're worth a similar amount of money. They want to at least double, if not triple, the amount of money that they get for their TV shows, and they realize that the best way to do that is to position themselves as being similar to sports programming. So there you go. And one of the other things that they're willing to do, apparently, depending on where they end up, because the rights for all of their shows are going to expire pretty much all at the same time, and that was done by design. They wanted everything to come up for expiration at once so they can offer it all as a package to a network or just in piecemeal. So Raw goes to this channel, SmackDown goes to this channel. They have options. They could do it either way. And one of the things they're willing to do is take SmackDown live. SmackDown has had live specials on occasion, but for years and years, SmackDown has been taped. It used to be on Thursday nights. Now it's on Friday nights. They're willing to take SmackDown live, assuming that people are willing to pay more money. Costs would go up if you wanted to do the show live. And so the show would have to be on Tuesday nights. I just can't see them keeping SmackDown on Fridays but going live, because then guys would have to fly in earlier. It completely messes everything up. So my guess would be that Raw would be live on Mondays and SmackDown would be live on Tuesdays, provided they can get a better fee. So if they can get somebody, whether it's Sci-Fi or whoever, to pay them more money than what they're getting now for SmackDown, they'll take that extra money and put those dollars towards making the show live. I don't know, you know, will that get more people to watch? Maybe a little bit, but I won't be one of them. And I'm just one example. It depends on people's schedules. If SmackDown suddenly is live every week on Tuesdays, you know, for me, that's a gym night. I go to the gym with a couple of buddies. I can't change that to a different night because that inconveniences other people. I have shit to do. So are other people going to feel the same way or going to bring in this whole new audience that otherwise never pays attention to SmackDown? I don't know, but it's a bold move if they do it. And I do think that you would have some additional audience watching the show that you don't know. The article says WWE is in their negotiation period right now with NBC Universal for, you know, Raw, SmackDown, Total Divas, Tribute to the Troops. Again, everything is part of the package here. And interestingly, they've spoken to a bunch of other networks already, or at least that's what they claim in the article. Maybe they say that to put pressure on NBC, but they claim they've had discussions with A&E, with Viacom, which is another conglomerate like NBC Universal, 21st Century Fox, Discovery, and Disney. That'll get people talking. WWE on Disney? I have a hard time picturing that, but it is a PG product, so who knows? Maybe it could happen. Right now, the company makes $139.5 million a year in TV rights fees. And Vince McMahon said at one of their conference calls in the last few months, he said himself, this was straight from Vince's mouth, he would allow one of the callers, somebody called in on the call, and Vince said, I'll let you put me in a hammerlock if WWE does not at least double the money that we make now. I think he may have even used the magic word guarantee. So note that, because if they don't double what they make, Vince McMahon's going to get put in a hammerlock, and I hope they get that on video. So negotiations and bids do not take place until February 15th. Right now, everything's in the discussion phase. So what's going to happen is, on the 15th of February, NBC Universal is either going to accept or reject whatever WWE's final offer is. They'll say, this is what we want. Are you giving it to us or not? NBC will let them know their decision. Other bids, if other networks want to put in a bid, are due by February 28th. And what's going to happen is a decision is going to be made by March 4th. And should a new deal happen and they are going to move away from USA Network and Sci-Fi and all these channels to something else, I don't know if it'll be Disney, Fox Sports, whatever it may be, those shows won't move until October. So you're going to have this very awkward period of 6 or 8 months where it's like this lame duck period. You know these guys are on the way out. And I just remember, even as a fan, it just felt weird when they left USA the first time to go to Spike and when they left Spike to go back to USA. And there was some stuff at the end there between WWE and Spike where they got very, very petty and they wouldn't let them even mention the fact that they were going back to USA. So if they do go somewhere else, it's going to be a very awkward several months, I think. The other interesting thing as far as the network goes, and this is what the article said, which tells me that they got this directly from WWE, so this all but confirms what we've been talking about and what we've been hearing, is that pay-per-views like WrestleMania and SummerSlam are going to be part of the new network, which will also have original series like Legends House, and access to the company's video-on-demand library. And WWE says that they can break even on the whole thing. All they got to do is sign up anywhere from 800,000 to a million subscribers, paying anywhere from $10 to $14 a month, and they can break even. That's their model. That's what they need. They need a million subscribers, even for an internet-only network, to break even. So those are your two big stories right there heading into 2014. And those will be the two big stories for WWE next year. How do things shake out with the TV rights? And what happens once they launch this network? Is it a bust? Is it a flop? Do they do well? Do they hit a million subscribers by the middle of the year? Are they making money off the thing? And I mean, a wrestling network is something that when I was a kid as a fan seemed like fantasy. It seemed like that would have been the greatest thing in the world. And now we're that much closer to actually having something like this. Those two things and the money that they're putting into all this and the money they're hoping to get out of the TV rights stuff is going to really dictate the future of this company. So those are two of the biggest stories of 2014 to watch for. The Batista news breaking so late in the week kind of threw me off schedule here, and I knew I wanted to talk about that first and spend some time on that. So for those of you looking for an NXT review this week, it was a big episode. It was the 200th episode of NXT, and it was great. And there's a full review of NXT 200 up on our YouTube channel right now. I did it as a separate video. You can subscribe to the channel, Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll find it. The video is up there. It's a full review of this past week's NXT, why it was such a good show. This was also the show that had Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, the American Wolves, getting their first tryout for WWE. They wrestled the Ascension, so I talk about that match, and I get into some of the reasons why Triple H, who ultimately the decision is his, whether or not they get signed or not, and Davey Richards made some interesting comments at a PWG show on Friday night that I get into, and if they haven't been signed, why Triple H may be hesitant to sign these two guys. There's two reasons in particular why he may be hesitant to do so. So if you want to know more about that, the full NXT review for this week only, check out our YouTube channel. The video is up there. It's a Sound Off Extra. That's where you can find it. TNA had its final resolution edition of Impact this past Thursday night, a tape show from Orlando. Magnus is the new TNA World Heavyweight Champion after beating Jeff Hardy in a Dixieland match, which is an escape the cage match to a ladder on the stage with the title suspended above. They had a really good match. They both had their working shoes on for this one. Jeff Hardy is an absolute crazy man. He did a whisper in the wind from the top of the cage, which scared the hell out of me. It gave me flashbacks to when Kurt Angle did a moonsault from the top of the cage. Not only in TNA, he did one there, but he did that in a cage match on Raw once against Chris Benoit. And if I remember, I think he blew out his knee in doing so. So that was dumb. Hardy's character does have a history of making dumb decisions like this. I think it was a tag team cage match at Survivor Series 1 year. It may have been 2001 when they were still doing the WWF against the Alliance stuff. It was the Hardys against the Dudleys, and I remember Jeff climbing to the top, and instead of climbing out and getting the win for his team, instead he decided to do a swanton bomb off the top of the cage onto Bubba Ray Dudley through a table. Only Bubba moved, and Hardy crashed and burned. So when there's a title on the line and you have a chance to win in a cage match, take the win. That's my advice. Early in the show, Magnus did a promo with Hardy in the ring and accused him of taking a shortcut from Dixie Carter because, if you remember, the week before, we saw footage of Hardy meeting with Dixie for dinner. So Magnus accused Jeff of selling out, when, of course, we would find out later that Hardy, in fact, did not sell out. So they did the old Tatanka Lex Luger angle from 1994, where we saw all these vignettes, all these segments that would lead you to believe that Luger had sold out to the Million Dollar Man. Tatanka walked into DiBiase's dressing room one day, I think it was, and Luger was in there. All these things that happened that wanted to plant the seeds to make you believe that Luger had sold out to the Million Dollar Man. And Tatanka kept accusing him of, you know, selling out for the almighty dollar, when in the end it was Tatanka who sold out. So that was basically the angle here. In the match, once both guys escaped the cage, Ethan Carter came down. He got laid out. Dixie blocked Jeff Hardy from climbing the ladder, but eventually, you know, he did climb. He was this close from becoming the champion when Rockstar Spud walked out and tipped over the ladder. And Hardy took a spill. He took this awesome bump onto the ramp. It was just brutal. You know, his head smacked against the ground. It knocked him out. This allowed Magnus to recover. He climbed the ladder, and he grabbed the title. And I believe this makes Magnus the first British-born world heavyweight champion in the history of American wrestling, at least wrestling on a national level. I can't speak for every indie that's out there, but I think he's the first. And to think, at one time, I thought Wade Barrett would be the first. He was well on his way. But his star has fallen pretty hard, which is an indictment, I think, on how WWE treat some of its talent, because Barrett's really good and they just don't have a clue what to do with him anymore. Final scene was Magnus celebrating with Dixie Carter, Ethan Carter III, and Rockstar Spud. So I guess they may be a new heel corporate faction now. Magnus is now the face of TNA. He's Dixie's chosen champion. You know what I really liked about that scene at the end of Impact? It's all young guys. It's all new faces. It's not Jeff Hardy. It's not Kurt Angle. It's not Hulk Hogan. It's not Sting. It's Magnus, who's 27 years old, and they can build around him as their guy if they want to, and if they really want to get him over. If they believe in him that much, he's the guy. You know, it's EC3, who was a jobber in WWE. It was Derek Bateman on NXT. He was going nowhere. Maybe he can be something in TNA. I'm not totally sold on him yet, but maybe. Rockstar Spud is too small to take seriously in the ring against any of the top guys. I'm sorry. But in his role as Dixie's lackey, he's been excellent. He's been great. I've really liked him in this role. So they're trying. They're trying to push younger talent. They're trying to push new faces. And maybe it's because they don't have a choice. Maybe they've been pushed into this scenario. You know, if TNA brought all those names in, like Hogan and Flair and Angle and Sting and Hardy and RVD, and they did, and their ratings went up and they were making more money, guess what? Magnus and Ethan Carter and all these guys would be on the undercard. So it's not like TNA suddenly found religion and said, oh my God, you know, we've been doing it wrong this whole time. The whole time we should have been pushing younger guys. They're pushing younger guys because they got no other choice, because nothing else that they've tried has worked. So I give them credit to a point, but I like what they're doing, you know, and I don't know where, you know, a guy like Sam Shaw, who was one of the few gut check winners still under contract that they didn't get rid of. I don't know where Sam Shaw has been. It's been 2 weeks since we've seen another vignette with him and Christy Hemme on TV, but I assume he'll be popping up again sometime soon. His new character also intrigues me. So I like that. I like what they've been doing with these guys. With EC3, they seem to be building to a match with him and Sting at some point. Maybe the live Genesis show they have coming up on January 16th. Sting already put Magnus over strong at Bound for Glory, tapped out to the Scorpion. So maybe using him to do the same thing for Ethan Carter wouldn't be a bad idea if they're really committed to making the character into a legit threat. The dude's been a joke so far. He's wrestled jobbers. At some point, he has to get a big win over someone with legitimacy, and Sting would certainly fit that bill. And I have to give some praise to Sting. I am not a fan of this feast or fired gimmick they have, but they revealed who got what briefcase from the previous week. They did a whole segment on this, and Sting interrupted the segment to cut a promo on Ethan and his aunt, Aunt D, as he calls her. And I thought Sting was awesome. He was so, so great in this segment. He's... You know, in just the last 2 or 3 years in TNA, think about this. Sting has been in wrestling for over 25 years. And I think he's done the best mic work of his entire career just in the last couple of years in TNA. And before EC3 opened his briefcase, Sting offered to take it from him. He said, listen, I'll take that briefcase from you, and I'll take whatever consequence there is. Because there could be a pink slip in there. I could lose my job. I could be fired. He offered to take that from EC3, or EC3 could agree to wrestle Sting in a match. And so Carter, you know, stands up, he teases taking Sting up on his offer, then he chickens out, he says, you know what, I'll take my chances, I'll keep the briefcase, which turned out to be a tag team title shot. So maybe he picks Sting as his tag team partner instead of doing the singles match right away. I guess we'll see. I still think they're doing a singles match at Genesis. Maybe they delay it a little bit. The other briefcases had Zema Ion getting an X Division title shot, Gunner getting a world title shot, which James Storm did not seem very happy about. And as I predicted, Chavo Guerrero gets the pink slip. He's fired, so adios, Chavo. For a so-called pay-per-view, free, on Spike TV, they had very few matches on this show. They only had three. But the ones that opened and closed the show were both very strong. Madison Rayne and ODB beat Gail Kim and Lady Tappa. And Bobby Roode beat Kurt Angle in a 2 out of 3 falls match. Not as good as their previous matches, but still, you know, still a good match. Roode took the first fall. Angle beat him with the Angle Slam for the second fall. And Roode won the third with a victory roll while holding onto the ropes, like any good heel would do. Backstage after the match, they interviewed Kurt. He was great. He just could not believe it. He couldn't believe that he lost. He didn't know what to do with himself. He just refused to accept the fact that Bobby Roode had outsmarted him. But, you know, you could tell for the first time there's doubt that maybe he really isn't as good as he once was. And Angle was great here, just the way he played this all up. I said this weeks ago when they did the injury angle, which I thought was kind of dumb on TV. The way they left it, you almost thought, oh, is Kurt Angle dead? And then they almost didn't even bother following up on it. Kind of like Big Show when he... had his post-concussion issues on Raw, whatever, after Survivor Series. And then it was never mentioned again. He's been fine ever since, after Orton punt-kicked him. But they had a video up on the Impact Wrestling website after that match. This is weeks ago, where Kurt gave maybe the best acting performance I've ever seen him give, either in wrestling or any of the crappy movies that he's done. And he was great here also. The only other thing on this show was an in-ring segment with Eric Young telling Joseph Park, "You are Abyss," and that he went and got Park a match against Daniels and Kazarian on next week's show. But not just any match, a Monsters Ball match. Abyss's specialty. And Joe Park was very reluctant about this. He flat out refused. He said, "I'm not doing it." Eric Young started showing him various hardcore objects, thumbtacks, barbed wire. Nothing would change Joe Park's mind until Eric told him, "Hey, look under the ring." And when he did, Joe Park found Janice, the board with the nails in it that Abyss once used to nearly murder Rob Van Dam. I still think it's funny they named it after Dixie's mom. So Joe Park has Janice in his hands, and all of a sudden he changes his tune. He says, "You know what? Okay, I'll do the match." And so Abyss is on his way back. Joe Park is on his way out. And this all makes me very sad. But the main event was really good. I would say, go out of your way to see it. It was the crowning of Magnus. We're going to see how far he goes. They're strapping the rocket to him. He's the new world champion. Where AJ fits into all this. And he does. He is going to be back on TV shortly. But that is a great segue into AJ Styles. The latest in the AJ Styles story. AJ posted a statement on his website at the beginning of the week that read, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read part of it here. He said, "Today, for the first time in 11 years, AJ Styles wakes up to find himself without a pro wrestling contract. I can't help but think, how did I get here? What must I have done wrong? Did I not deliver in the ring? All of those are pertinent questions that any man or woman who finds himself or herself unemployed would ask. I've always prided myself in being the best wrestler, or rather, not being the best wrestler, but being the wrestler that stays away from the things in this business that could easily destroy myself, my family, my marriage, even my career. A wrestler who goes above and beyond to give the fans what they pay to see. I move forward not bitter, but better for the blessings and memories that I have been a part of since TNA's inception." And it went on from there. It was a longer statement. Now, I listened to the interview that AJ Styles did with Mike Johnson over on PWInsider.com in their subscriber section. He got the first crack at AJ, and he spoke to him for an hour. And that interview went up the same day that Styles officially became a free agent, because the extension that he signed, his contract originally was up in October, right around Bound for Glory time, I believe. And he and TNA agreed to extend it, or at least agreed that he would remain as part of the company for an additional, I think, 2 months it was. And so they've been negotiating the entire time for a new deal. And that extension expired. He went, he talked to Mike Johnson, they did the interview. And it's a really good one, gave you a lot of insight into the mindset of the guy throughout these negotiations, how he really feels about the whole thing, and how he views his body of work over the 11 years working for TNA. And the key takeaways for me, after listening to that interview, in his own words, is that, first of all, it's not a work. I didn't think it was anyway, because if they're working us, I don't see what purpose it serves. You know, in the context of the storyline on television, he's been without a contract since Bound for Glory. Nobody watching that television show knows that he signed an extension and his contract really only expired this past week. That's only something you would know if you were backstage in TNA or one of the moles who leaks this information, or one of AJ's people who's probably been leaking some information to help give him some leverage in the negotiations. But only a select few people or people on the internet who read some of these reports would even know that any of this is happening. So for him to announce that now my deal has expired and I'm moving on, and his match with Magnus hasn't even aired on TV yet, it won't until the beginning of next year, it doesn't make sense. You're already airing vignettes on TV with footage of the guy wrestling in Japan, wrestling in Mexico. You know, in that way, you've already done a better job than WWE did with the same angle with CM Punk. So for it to be a work now, all of a sudden, it makes no sense. But this is TNA. It's been 2 years since my interview with Jay Lethal, and I'm still trying to figure out why they let a guy like that go. Even he didn't know when I spoke to him. That was episode 187, by the way, if you want to go back and check that out. It's actually up on our YouTube channel. TNA has made plenty of weird decisions before, but you've got AJ here quoting Bible verses in his statement. I don't think AJ Styles is working God here. But he also made it very clear in the interview that he and TNA are still having a dialogue. There is still talk going on between the two sides. There were some reports that went up a few days ago, as I'm recording this, that they may have already reached a deal. I don't think that's the case. Since then, I think they've backed off those reports and said, no, in fact, he has not signed the new deal, but they're getting a little bit closer, but still not a lot of positive movement. They're pretty much still stuck in the same position that they were in before. And so they are still talking through his agent. It's still possible he can re-sign with TNA. He said, contrary to some reports that have leaked, he never asked for more money. He said there were other factors involved. He was content to keep the same deal he had before, and it sounds like that's the sticking point. TNA is so hard up for money that they can't even keep AJ at the same deal he had before. But as of today, he is without a TNA contract, and he's already got a bunch of indie dates lined up through March. He's got a match with Chris Hero for Smash Wrestling in Toronto next month. He and Amazing Red are wrestling the Young Bucks for House of Glory on February 15th. He'll be in England for Preston City Wrestling on March 1st. He's got a match with Eddie Edwards on March 14th, assuming that Eddie doesn't sign with WWE first. So he's going to keep himself busy. He's got an autobiography coming out next year, which is more of a Christian-themed book, but it does talk a lot about his wrestling career. And in the interview he did, he spoke very highly of Ring of Honor, and he basically said he's not signing any contracts until the stuff with TNA is worked out one way or the other. So if you're going to go to Preston City Wrestling in England for a one-shot, that's different. With ROH, you got to sign a contract. They have TV, so it's a whole different ballgame. And he admitted, listen, I'm still talking to TNA. It's still possible we can reach a deal. We just haven't. But I love ROH. You know, I made a name for myself there. And, you know, if they don't reach a deal, perhaps we will see him sign a deal to come back to ROH. Or who knows, maybe WWE will actually show some interest in him. I know they've got 75 guys down in developmental right now. They don't need any TNA guys, but when you have a guy the caliber of AJ Styles who's looking for a new place to work, you'd be a fool not to bring him in. So he was very open in the interview about the fact that he did not get along well with Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff when they first came into TNA. He was not a fan of them doing away with the six-sided ring. He felt that was part of TNA's identity that they were stripping away. But as time went on, he actually came to get along really well with Bischoff. I don't know about Hogan, but with Bischoff he did. And he came to appreciate how much easier the normal four-sided ring is on their bodies. He talked about the Claire Lynch angle, everyone's favorite angle, I'm sure, which he actually thought the Claire Lynch angle was good. He thought it was good stuff until the actress who played her decided to leave the company because the fans were harassing her online. And he actually was pretty brutal towards the woman who played her, I thought. You know, he may not have intended to come across that way, but he talked about how, and this is AJ speaking, he said if TNA had hired a really smoking hot woman to play the part, he doesn't think fans would have complained as much and turned on her as much. And how, to them, it didn't make any sense that in the fans' eyes, AJ would, and this is in his own words here, he thought to the fans it didn't make sense that AJ would be banging a chick who looked like her as opposed to someone, I guess, who looked like a supermodel or a playmate. So, you know, poor Claire Lynch. I hope she wasn't listening to that. It's a good interview, though. If you're a subscriber over there, I suggest checking it out over on PW Insider. If you put me on the spot and ask me how I think things end up, I do think that he and TNA will end up reaching an agreement and he'll be back. If he isn't, and you know what? Even if he does re-sign, shame on TNA. Shame on TNA for allowing this to happen and for letting this whole thing drag out as long as it has. It's just, it's embarrassing. We're not talking about some mid-card guy like Chris Sabin or Ethan Carter. We're talking about the number one guy in the promotion. And I wonder, how must that make some of the other guys feel? The longtime guys, Rude, Daniels, Joe, how are they going to feel when their deals come up? If they weren't willing to go the extra mile for AJ Styles, what makes them think Dixie won't ask them to take a pay cut? It's a morale thing more than anything else. And then I look at a guy like Sting. I mean, he's got to be the most loyal guy I have ever seen. Either Spike and TNA are paying him even more money than any of us can imagine for the bare minimum amount of work. It's not like he's been wrestling much of late. He doesn't do many live events. I would imagine he'll be on their UK tour next month. I don't know if he's on the lineup or not. I guess he's, you know, if he's got a good gig going, why give it up? But if ever there was a time for him to cut bait, this would be it. And there's absolutely no indication at all that he's leaving TNA for WWE. If I had to take a guess, he's probably sticking around for another year. And if he wants to just make his money for the bare minimum and help put younger guys over like Magnus and Ethan Carter, then I commend him. But he's got nothing left to prove in that company. He spent 7 years of his career there. He's won multiple world titles, which he can't even wrestle for anymore, and that's for the better. He's put people over. He's reinvented his character a couple of times. Joker Sting, Real Estate Steve as part of the Main Event Mafia. He's come out, you know, he comes out now wearing that t-shirt whenever he wrestles, and it just doesn't feel special anymore. Whatever specialness may be left, it just seems like such a waste to me to not go to WWE right now, sign a 3-month deal or a 6-month deal, you know, like Batista probably did. Work a program with The Undertaker. If Undertaker's busy with Brock or The Shield, hell, work a program with Kane. Maybe Sting shows up at the Rumble or at the Elimination Chamber. I don't know for what reason. I'm just thinking off my head here. But let's say he's no favorite of the Authority, and so they start something with him and Libertarian Kane, as I call him. Only Sting causes Kane to revert back to his darker side, at least for one program. Because as much as everybody talks about Sting and The Undertaker, I always thought the old school masked version of Kane against Sting would also have been pretty badass. And it's not like they're doing anything with Kane right now. They're completely wasting him. He's the fucking bailiff from Night Court. He just stands in the background. That's all he is. Whoever it is, Undertaker, Sting, Triple H, Bray Wyatt, I mean, whoever. Sting comes in for a big payoff at WrestleMania. He can get himself a Hall of Fame induction, which he's more than worthy of. Get himself the big DVD treatment, which I'm sure WWE would love. Did you know, I just read this a few weeks ago. Did you know those WCW releases they put out, and they put a whole bunch of them out on DVD this year? You know, the Goldberg Collection, the Best of War Games. They did a Best of Starrcade. I don't know if that was last year or this year. Aside from WrestleMania 29, those were the best-selling DVDs WWE put out all year long. They were all the WCW releases. A 3-disc Sting collection just with his WCW stuff alone would do big business. And at this stage, whatever concerns he may have had 10 years ago with how WWE would treat his character if he ever came over, and rightfully so. I mean, Sting did an interview. I don't know what it was part of. There may have been some sort of Sting movie or Sting documentary. I don't know, but you can find the clip on YouTube years and years ago where he remembers, Sting does, the first time Booker T appeared on WWE television, opposite The Rock. And The Rock was just like, "Who in the blue hell are you?" And he just thought that was so disrespectful and such a knock on WCW. And, you know, would they do that to me? Would they do that to Sting? Who the hell is this guy? And I get all that. But now, it's all these years later, he's at the end of his career. WWE is desperate for stars. I mean, from 10 years ago to now, they've never had a period, I don't think, in their history, not their recent history, where they have so few true stars. They'd only have to get the guy for a limited window. It's not like he's working a full schedule. So if he doesn't sign with them now, with everything that's been going on with TNA, he will go down as one of the most loyal men in the history of wrestling, because if this were anybody else, they'd have been out the door a long time ago. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to thesolemonster@gmail.com. That includes audio questions, which you can attach in MP3 format only. Please include the text of your question in the body of an email. And for everybody, please try to include your name and where you're from. Chris from Chicago, what happened to referee Scott Armstrong? You know, that's a damn good question. I didn't even realize he was still gone until you sent me this question. They did that angle with him at Night of Champions where he fast-counted Daniel Bryan, Triple H fired him, and he was never spoken of again. And looking back on it, I'm not really sure what the whole point of that whole angle even was. But he's still employed, as far as I know. Ramey from Morocco, whenever I hear that Eric Bischoff took the idea of the NWO from Japan, I'm always left with two questions. What Japanese promotion did this idea originate with? And who were some of the wrestlers involved? Well, that would be New Japan Pro Wrestling. Bischoff attended one of their shows about a month or so before Scott Hall first debuted on Nitro. I think there may have been some WCW guys wrestling on the show, so that's why he was there. And what happened is the UWFI promotion was not doing all that well. There was a UWF, and then there was kind of a splinter faction group, whatever, called UWFI. They were supposed to be more of a shoot fight type of pro wrestling. So the promotion was formed by a bunch of wrestlers who had been in New Japan originally, but they were disgruntled. They wanted a more, you know, realistic product, so they left. Fast forward all these years later to the mid-90s, they reach an agreement to do this interpromotional angle with New Japan, and New Japan gets full control over the booking. So as you might imagine, most of their guys end up winning, of course. And they did multiple shows. They did more than one. They might have done two or three different shows pitting New Japan guys against UWFI guys. And it did big business. And I don't remember the names of the guys involved, but I'm sure a simple Google search will probably give you at least some of their names. James from Detroit, I was going through the archives of your show, and an idea you proposed on Sound Off episode 122 caught my attention. You discussed the possibility of giving Kane and Undertaker a Sister of Destruction, and this amazed me because I too had thought about this possibility with NXT Women's Champion Paige fitting that role. The backstory could be that the late Paul Bearer bared an illegitimate child overseas in England who grew up a fan of wrestling, specifically her father and famous brothers, and has worked towards one day being able to share the same ring with them. With her pale skin and gothic demeanor, I think Paige would be perfect for this role. I know you said that ship has sailed, even more so now with Kane going corporate and Undertaker barely on TV, but do you think this could still work? No. My opinion hasn't changed. I love the idea of a Sister of Destruction. That's why I talked about it all those years ago. And I think at the time, I wasn't really familiar with Paige. I think I had this image of Daphne in my head, because Daphne also portrayed that goth type of character, and I thought maybe she would work in that role, or they could just find somebody completely different. Plus, Daphne also kind of had, or at least had at that time, more of like a pasty, pale kind of reflection. She was still hot, but now it's pointless. There's no reason to do it. Kane's doing what he's doing, but Undertaker's just not around. I mean, you would need Undertaker to be around more often to help sell the angle and stuff, and it's too late. The perfect time to do that would have been years ago, many years ago. But I still like the idea. It's just you can't do it now. Kieran from Sheffield, England. Considering that Dean Ambrose has held the U.S. title for so long, how do you think he should lose the belt, and who do you think he should lose it to? I think someone like a Dolph Ziggler, Kofi Kingston, or Mark Henry could potentially beat Ambrose, but they don't need to be the U.S. champion. I like the idea of a fluke win by someone like a Tyson Kidd over Ambrose, or some sort of interference could cost him the match. That way, Dean is not hurt, and the title is on somebody who can benefit from holding the belt. What do you think? I think he should lose it to the baggage handlers at the airport. That's what I think. Just let the fucking thing get lost and never be seen again. It's completely useless. Just get rid of the damn belt if it's never going to be defended. Just having a belt doesn't help anybody. And if they win it on a fluke or some kind of slip on a banana peel kind of finish, what good does that do Tyson Kidd? So he lucked into a shitty belt that nobody cares about. Just unify it with the Intercontinental title. That way we only have one belt that nobody cares about instead of two. It'll be an improvement. Ben from Fresno, California. I've started to listen to your past shows. In an episode from January 2010, you said that USA Network repeatedly asked WWE to expand Raw to 3 hours and that WWE had plenty of resentments towards the idea. According to the Sound Off episode that I heard, you stated Vince McMahon had remarked once that ideally Raw would only be 90 minutes long. Now that it has changed to 3 hours, did Vince have a change of heart and decide that he can make 3-hour shows work, or did USA pull an idiot move and decide to make Raw 3 hours? If USA did do that, do you think Vince McMahon still believes the idea of a 90-minute show? The 90-minute show stuff comes from, I don't remember if it was, Keller or Meltzer, because they actually would speak with Vince McMahon on a fairly regular basis back in the day before they, you know, cut off the wrestling media, so to speak. And I think it may have stemmed from an actual conversation that one of them had with Vince where, you know, Vince admitted, you know, 90 minutes would be the perfect length for a wrestling show, but it wasn't realistic because then you have that extra half hour. How does the network fill it? So, you know, the shows were 2 hours long. I mean, I can't get in Vince's brain. Does he still think 90 minutes is a good idea? I don't know. Maybe. Probably not from making money. He's making some additional money off the third hour. Third hour, let alone two. So maybe that's changed his mind. I have no idea. But I think 90 minutes is a good length. And if you look at Hulu, a lot of people will watch Raw. And I think the Hulu version of Raw is usually edited down to 90 minutes. Maybe somebody who actually watches Raw on there could fill me in, because I haven't watched Raw on Hulu. I'm going by what other people have said. And they condense it down to about 90 minutes by cutting out all the BS that you don't have to see. Well, wouldn't it be nice if Raw was just 90 minutes of stuff that people wanted to see and there's no BS to even have to cut out of the show in the first place? So I'd be in favor of a 90-minute Raw. I'd be in favor of a two-hour Raw. Anything but three. Three is just way too long. Ben's second question, did Vince McMahon gain even more heat from Bret Hart for continuing the 1999 Over the Edge pay-per-view after Owen's accident happened? I remember my dad telling me there was more heat. Nevertheless, I've always had this curiosity about that question. Well, I remember Bret Hart going on some of the morning shows like the Today Show, I think, Good Morning America with Owen's widow after the accident happened. And he was a big critic of Vince McMahon and WWE for continuing the show. So yeah, for a while, Bret had more heat. You know, I don't know that he blamed Vince McMahon for killing his brother, but he certainly held them responsible for forcing Owen to do something that Bret claimed Owen didn't want to do. He said Owen had reservations about doing the stunt, which always was bizarre to me because I'm pretty sure Owen did that stunt at least one time before that on TV. But I mean, even so, I mean, maybe he was afraid of heights. He didn't want to do it again, whatever the situation was. And at some point, Bret either stopped talking about it because he got back in the good graces of WWE, or maybe his tune changed, because obviously you don't hear him saying those things much anymore. And a lot of that could very well have to do with the fact that he's got a good working relationship with them and they, you know, pay him money now. So for a while, yeah. Yeah, he did have more heat with Vince, and it looks like a lot of that heat has gone away. This comes from Hitton. If Rock does come back next year, how would you feel about a segment with Randy Orton? Not necessarily a match, considering he did all he could with the WWE title this past year, but I think a segment building from their Raw angle back in 2003-2004, which was based on both being third-generation stars and the youngest champions when they won their first title. If they're really pushing Orton this much, then I think this would only help. You know, Brock Lesnar or whoever can then come back and attack Rock afterwards to lead to whatever his actual match would be for Mania. I don't think Rock is wrestling in Mania, just for the record. Maybe he'll come back, it'll be a surprise, but it doesn't look like he's being factored into their WrestleMania plans. And I don't see what purpose a Rock Orton segment would serve unless it's building to a match. I don't even know that most people would remember. I don't even remember there being a segment between Rock and Orton on Raw back in 03. Maybe some people listening to this can jog my memory. I'm sure I must have watched the show. I've seen every episode of Raw from that period. Didn't leave much of an impression on me since I don't remember that segment. I know Rock came back to team with Foley to face Evolution at WrestleMania 20, so maybe it was one of those Raws before WrestleMania. There was some interaction with Rock and Orton, but I don't remember. And I bet most people who watch Raw these days wouldn't remember that either. So it's pointless. I see no purpose in it. Finally, Robert from Queens, New York writes in, would you recommend going to WrestleMania 30 solo? My friends don't have the money anymore, but I myself have the money for tickets for each event. I just haven't ordered anything yet because I was waiting on them. Since they're not going anymore, I'm debating if my first WrestleMania should be by myself, or should I just wait until WrestleMania 31 and go with my friends then? That's a decision that you're going to have to make. If it were me, if I had the money and I had never been to WrestleMania before and I wanted to go, I'd probably go. I mean, you're going to be around a shit ton of wrestling fans WrestleMania weekend in New Orleans, okay? I've been to two WrestleManias now. It's a lot of fun. In fact, all the experiences around the different events, you can go to indie events, they'll have conventions, they'll have access, Hall of Fame. I mean, Raw the next night after WrestleMania is more fun than WrestleMania itself. You're going to have a lot of fun just hanging out with fellow wrestling fans, just drinking and just, you know, making new friends and just enjoying New Orleans. I've never been to New Orleans before. It's a vacation destination. If you've never been there, go. You'll probably have fun. Don't let your friends, you know, spoil all the fun for you, and then you can go with them anyway next year. That would be my advice.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we go back 34 years to December 17th, 1979. A pretty famous WWF card at Madison Square Garden aired on television, both here and in Japan, because this came right after the WWF title controversy over there with Bob Backlund and Antonio Inoki. What happened is Inoki beat Backlund for the title in a match in Japan, and like a week later, Backlund won the belt back from him. But the president of the WWF at the time, and he was a figurehead president, much the same way Jack Tunney was back in the day. He held no actual power. It was just a role that he played. Tunney was actually a local promoter for WWF up in Canada, and I had no idea there was a figurehead president before Tunney, but there was. Hisashi Shinma was his name. He was the president from 1978 to 1984, which is when Tunney replaced him. He had been the chairman of New Japan Pro Wrestling, and he helped broker a talent agreement between WWF and New Japan. That's where the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship came from. They retired the title in 85 after WWF and New Japan had a falling out. And then a few months later, New Japan created the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title, which is the same title held today by Prince Devitt. See, so the more you know. Anyway, when Backlund won the belt back in the rematch, it was Shinma who ended up ruling it a no contest because there was outside interference, and he gave the belt back to Inoki. And Inoki refused to accept it back, and so the title was declared vacant. Fast forward to this show at MSG, and Backlund beat Bobby Duncombe in a Texas death match to win back the vacant title, which was never mentioned to the fans here in the U.S. They never mentioned the fact that the championship was vacant, nor is Inoki's reign officially recognized in the title history on WWE.com. And I don't remember them mentioning it either when they inducted him into the Hall of Fame back in 2010. So we're supposed to believe that Backlund had this uninterrupted 5.5-year reign as champion, just like we're supposed to believe that Randy Orton is the first ever undisputed champion in the company. Chris Jericho's reign is up there with the American Badass version of The Undertaker as things you're not supposed to talk about because they didn't happen. Inoki also wrestled on this show, by the way. Harley Race beat Dusty Rhodes to retain his NWA World Heavyweight title by ref stoppage due to excessive blood loss. So yeah, there was an NWA title defense on a WWF show, and some guy named Hulk Hogan made his Madison Square Garden debut on this show, beating a young Ted DiBiase with a bear hug. So this was a stacked card back in 79. 14 years ago this week, on December 19th, 1999, WCW holds its Starrcade pay-per-view. Bret Hart retained his WCW World Heavyweight title over Bill Goldberg. They tried to recreate the Montreal finish with Bret locking Goldberg in the sharpshooter and Roddy Piper, who was the guest referee, calling for the bell, even though Goldberg never gave up. And Bret looked confused. A lot of people probably had a confused look on their face when it came to WCW booking during this period. The idea was that Vince Russo told Roddy Piper to, quote, give Bret the win as a way to make up for what happened to him in Montreal. This was the infamous match where Goldberg mule-kicked Bret in the head and gave him a really bad concussion that went undiagnosed for several weeks. Bret kept wrestling. He ended up with post-concussion syndrome and was advised by doctors to retire, and that's what he did. And then 2 years later, he fell off his bicycle and he suffered a stroke. 2 years ago this week, on December 18th, 2011, WWE's TLC pay-per-view features a match between Zack Ryder and Dolph Ziggler for the United States Championship, and Ryder wins the title from Ziggler. Boy, does that feel like a lifetime ago. It's been downhill for Zack Ryder ever since, and Dolph Ziggler's not faring much better these days either. And in the big blow-off to their epic feud, and by epic I mean epically bad, Triple H beat Kevin Nash in a sledgehammer ladder match. Yes, as Nash will still joke these days, somebody must have been pulling a rib on him by thinking it would be a good idea to put Kevin Nash, of all people, in a ladder match. Wasn't very good. He did the best he could, which wasn't much. Triple H won what a complete and utter failure of a storyline that whole thing was. From Nash texting himself at SummerSlam to powerbombing CM Punk three times when Punk was at his hottest and Punk never getting any retribution, to Nash's unbelievably bad promos on TV every week. And Nash is one of the better promo guys in wrestling. He's a naturally funny, witty guy, but you shove a script in his face and put words in his mouth, and it just made for bad TV. 1 year ago this week, on December 16th, 2012, WWE's first pay-per-view ever from Brooklyn, New York, TLC at the Barclays Center. I was at that show, and it was quite great. The match of the year for WWE, in my opinion, in 2012, was the six-man tag. It was the Shield's very first match against Ryback, Daniel Bryan, and Kane. And I went back and watched this match again yesterday, you know, after I put it in my notes here. And I went back and watched the full match, and it's every bit as good now as it was a year ago, and maybe even more so, because now the Shield, they've been wrestling together for a year. They're a lot more polished. Reigns is a lot better. Ambrose is still great. Rollins is still great. But you watch that match back, and you know, Rollins was great. Ambrose was great. Reigns, you can kind of tell, he was still kind of finding himself in there. He'd throw these punches that look so weak. And now when I watch him in the ring, I don't see that at all. But you watch him back then, and he's a little rough around the edges. But the fact that it was their first match together, their first match on WWE television, and it was a match that had Ryback and Kane, who were not the best workers in the world. And they went out there and had a freaking awesome match. I mean, they had the best match of 2012 in WWE. So it was really good stuff. And then the main event was a ladder match for the Money in the Bank briefcase between Dolph Ziggler and John Cena. And Dolph Ziggler retained his Money in the Bank briefcase by beating Cena. That was where AJ Lee tipped over the ladder. It was the biggest win of Dolph Ziggler's career up to that point. And Ziggler's another guy you look at a year later and you just wonder what happened. What happened to this guy? It's just incredible. You look at him, you look at Wade Barrett. These are guys with talent. These are guys that could be world champions. And now there's only one belt, and it's going to be a lot harder for them to get to that level. I mean, it's better having only one belt. I'm glad they unified them. It does work against guys like Ziggler and guys like Barrett, but that's just how it is. And to think that WWE has guys that have this level of talent and they just seemingly don't know what to do with them. They got Barrett out there doing bad comedy behind a podium. Ziggler's losing main event matches on ION television to fucking Curtis Axel, who they have absolutely no plans for and is actually older than Ziggler. Just all these different things, and it makes you wonder. This is the same company. They're making millions of dollars. They're doing a lot of things right, but the stuff they do wrong is so bad. And just with some of these guys, how can you mess this up? Ziggler had momentum. I mean, when he pulled that briefcase down, he was the heel, and the place exploded. Now, yeah, it was New York, so they're going to be smartasses, but that, and then when he cashed in Money in the Bank the night after Mania, the guy had momentum, and they've just completely broken him. And it's really a shame. And that's this week in wrestling history. Again, if you have mailbag questions, please email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. You can also friend us on Facebook. We have a profile page, we have a fan page, and we have a discussion group, which I have to approve you for. So apply there, I will approve you. We now are over 800 members strong. I think we're up to like 806, so you can be 807. If you want to be part of our little community there. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. Again, the NXT review this week, which is a good one. I'm putting that up on YouTube. That'll be the only place you can find it. So that's reason enough to go subscribe to our channel. And there'll be more content going up in the future as well. You could find vintage episodes of the Sound Off from 2007 that you can't find anywhere else that are long gone from, you know, their original uploads. All that stuff is on YouTube, so find us on there. I will be at WWE's annual holiday house show at Madison Square Garden this Thursday. I was not planning on going, but as it turns out, I am. That's the day after Christmas, which means live tweeting from the show, so follow me. We're getting a cage match between the Rhodes Brothers and the Real Americans, so that should be a lot of fun. And then I think it's Cena Orton in the main event with Booker T as the referee. But it's not about the card, it's just, you know, a cheap ticket and just having some fun, so I'll be there. Like I said, follow me on Twitter. For the rest of you, have a very Merry Christmas. Happy Holiday. Happy New Year. We'll be back with a new show before the new year, but I'll wish you a Happy New Year anyway. And I hope you get everything you're looking for this holiday season. If you are so kind to make a PayPal donation to the Sound Off, I would appreciate that. So please think of doing that as well. And we'll be back next time with a new episode of the Sound Off. So until then, be well, stay safe, happy holidays, and we'll see you right back here next time. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
If you don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's name. I got to get rid of this bastard. I got to get rid of this club. This club sucks.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Sala Monster Sounds Off.